another 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.
Rare Collections.
Yes, you've found another edition of Rare Collections with me, Geordie Kilby.
And David Kilby.
And today we're looking at jazz rock, Australian jazz rock, a window that perhaps opens in the mid to late 1960s in Australia, and indeed around the world, and runs right through the 70s and into the 80s.
And it's sort of, you had that progression from rock and roll through to Beatles style, the British invasion, and then you had progressive rock coming in, and then this sort of jazz rock fusion.
Yeah, I guess in the late 60s, you have a bunch of jazz musicians who are beginning to look beyond jazz, and they start looking at rock and pop as a place to further their experimentation. And also rock and pop musicians who'd been playing, you know, that style of music for a while, looking to stretch out with a little bit of jazz improvisation over their rock arrangements.
So who are the influential ones, say, in the US, Jude?
Well, you'd be talking about people like Gary Burton, Larry Coryell, certainly Miles Davis and his Bitches Brew album from 1969, 70. Being very influential in this field, but also thinking about people like Bud Schenk, who released a series of albums in the mid-60s covering people like Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones and the Beatles.
They're in the album sort of charts, George, but in the 45, in the singles charts, you had groups like Blood, Sweat and Tears too, didn't you?
Absolutely, and Chicago were also big business.
Steely Dan
had a lot of hits in the late 70s. And in England, someone who was associated, of course, with the Mahavishnu Orchestra, John McLaughlin, guitarist there, but has a career going right back into the early 60s, playing with people like Graham Bond and also Georgie Fame, effectively playing jazz but over rhythm and blues arrangements.
And in Australia, a few sessions ago, we had a long talk with Sven Liebeck, and he was a bit of a leader here in Australia too, as far as this fusion is concerned.
Yeah, look, certainly Sven Liebeck was using a lot of jazz musicians on a lot of records that he made during the mid to late 1960s. An album he produced with Gary Shearston in 1967, Ab Reaction, had some of the cream of Australian jazz players on it: John Sangster, Ed Gaston, Peter Martin on guitar, and his Australian Suite, which is more of an orchestral piece, but at the heart of it was a jazz band. Again, John Sangster was on there, and Ed Gaston, but also Errol Buddle and Don Burrows, some of the really big names.
We should look at a couple of these then, I think, George.
We've spoken to a few key players, as I mentioned. You'll hear a little later from Jim Kelly, who was the guitarist with Crossfire. We've also spoken to Cole Loughnan from the great Australian jazz rock band Ayers Rock. We also spoke to Warren Daly, who was the drummer for many, many years with the Daly Wilson Big Band. And he's got a really, really interesting story. He started out in 1958 playing rock and roll music in a band called the Ramblers.
Playing Jerry Lee Lewis-style numbers.
And the Ramblers evolved into the Steeds when they realised they needed a little bit of a gimmick. And part of that involved getting a front man in.
Who looked like Crash Craddock.
And his name was Rod Stallion. So, of course, they became the Steeds. And Rod Stallion and the Steeds had a short career together, but the Steeds carried on into the mid-60s, put out one record in 1964 on Parlophone called Roadrunner, which didn't really go anywhere, unfortunately. But fortunately, Warren Daly and the Steeds were having a lot of success backing popular recording acts.
We didn't need to have hit records to survive, because we could all read, which was unusual for those days.
Sure.
And so we used to back all the major acts at the Trocadero dance, and 2,000 people used to turn up every Saturday afternoon, Coca-Cola bottlers dancers, and we would have the Allen Brothers, Johnny Reb, Lonnie Lee, Johnny Devlin, the Deltones, Lee Sellers, Jay Justin. If I didn't say the DeCru Brothers, certainly we backed them. Yeah, we just backed everybody, and so we were working constantly.
And that work carried him right through until the mid to late 60s, when he got a very interesting offer to go to the States and do some work he worked with a host of influential band leaders there, Cy Zettner being one, and he toured for several years as part of big bands there, which was a lifelong dream for him.
That's right, and played with some of the greats that he'd always admired. It's odd that we'd followed the career of Cy Zettner too, and he died a couple of years ago as well, but had a big band for a long, long time, changed with the times, and did versions of current hits in a jazz big band style.
So living the dream in the States, he'd always wanted to have a big band of his own, and something that he and Ed Wilson had tried to do in 1965 became more of a reality in around 1968. And it was while he was in the States he had a call from Ed Wilson to say, look, I think we've got enough musicians together to have a crack at it here at home in Australia. And that's what he did. He came back home, and they set about putting together the Daly Wilson Big Band.
But they wanted a band with a difference, didn't they, Joe? It wasn't going to be just another big band. It needed something.
Yes, we wanted to try and knock down all barriers. I mean, there had been such a barrier to progress laid down by the belief that you had to be cool when you played big band music. We wanted to be open, you know, lay yourself bare and play all the things that meant something to you and the new and young people. And so we started playing all of the rock things, the jazz rock things, and the jazz things. We kept all the jazz things in, and the people loved it. I think the secret to the band's success was excitement was the most important thing to us. If it wasn't exciting, we didn't play it. If we didn't play exciting in an exciting way, then we'd failed. And that really transmitted to the audience.
And they certainly came out of the blocks firing. Live at the Cell Block, there was a second album with Kerry Bedell up front. And for two or three years there, the band were firing on all cylinders, playing right around the country and filling halls left, right and centre.
With a huge amount of publicity too, because it was something... It was quite novel, quite new.
You heard him mention jazz rock there, and it's an interesting term, and we asked him for his definition of jazz rock.
Rock and roll has a certain feel about it, and we would continually cross with the feel jazz phrasing, jazz lines, traditional modern big band shout choruses, and rock just didn't do that, you know. We utilised the same rock rhythms, you know, as they would, but if you didn't watch us within the bat of an eyelid, we'd be, as in Shaft on that album, we'd be screaming along at a double tempo jazz feel.
And on the album he's talking about there is the Daly Wilson Big Band on Tour, which was their third album. So I mentioned they put a couple out. There was a little bit of a break in there where they just, although they were selling shows out left, right and centre, again, just keeping enough money sort of floating around to keep a band of that size on the road proved difficult. And it was only when they picked up some major tobacco sponsorship that they were able to get back on the road and do it bigger and better than ever. The tour that they did took them right around Australia. It took them across to New Zealand, into Southeast Asia. There was a documentary film made about the tour.
Through to America and through over to even places like Russia as well, George, where they went down a storm. As Warren said, over there they were starved of popular music, particularly music by people like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and the Daly Wilson Big Band were able to provide that, and they were hugely popular in Russia.
The track we want to play for you is from that first album from the reinvigorated Daly Wilson Big Band, and it's their version of Ode to Billy Joe.
It was after all the one-nighters we did in Australia, and so the band really hit its straps. It had on it some very fine playing, especially from Larry Elam, the late and great. He ended up in the top 10 trumpet classical players in the world. Talk about crossover from jazz players to rock. He was a classical player, and you'll hear him playing piccolo trumpet and enormous chops, as we call them. I love the arrangement. Ed and I did that arrangement. I hope you'll forgive me for saying that I love what we did, but I just do. It was such a lovely time, and that arrangement really spoke heaps about the fact that we made it a jazz rock arrangement, where, as you know, it really was nothing other than a pop, you know, country western rock thing.
Daly Wilson Big Band with their version of Ode to Billy Joe, a pop song but turned into a jazz rock tune.
And isn't it nice to hear a musician look back and say, you know, hope you don't mind, but I really like what we did.
Well, they were doing it pretty well, weren't they? To the point where visiting musicians were picking up copies of their records and taking them back overseas as an example of what they could do.
Well, they played for people like Sammy Davis and also for people like Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra's arranger and an occasional songwriter, Sonny Burke, was a great fan.
Sonny absolutely loved our band and used to take our records to sessions in Hollywood and put them on the turntable, would you believe this, and say, this is how I want you to play.
Really?
Yeah, Frank Sinatra Jr. told me that.
That's a pretty good endorsement, isn't it?
Very good.
You're listening to Recollections, David and Geordie Kilby with you. We look at corners of Australian pop history every couple of weeks, and today we're turning our gaze to the jazz rock movement. Next on the menu is Ayers Rock, who released a couple of albums in the mid-1970s, the first in 1974, Big Red Rock, and the second in 1976, Beyond. A couple of very influential jazz rock albums, and we spoke to Cole Lochman, who was one of the key players in the band, to learn a little more about the evolution of the Ayers Rock sound.
And Cole's another one who still has a long career. But we did ask him, how did it all start?
When I grew up, my neighbour was a very famous band leader here in Sydney and musician. His name was Frank Coghlan. He was the leader of the Trocadero Big Band. Well, he was my neighbour, and early on, I think if I had had my own way, I would have been playing the trumpet. I don't know if that would have been a curse or not, because most trumpet players complain about the instrument being that hard. Now, Frank was a trombonist, but he also played trumpet. And so I used to hear him practicing the trumpet across the back fence there. One day he gave me a mouthpiece when I was very young. Anyway, I was having a go at it in the backyard, and I went into the house and remembered, oh, gee, I want to get a trumpet like Mr. Coghlan. Can I get one? And it was no, 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 you can't have a trumpet.
As a result, he went on to quite a career working with vocal groups. He was in the band The Crescents, or the backing of the vocal group The Crescents.
Yeah, a vocal group on their own and also as a backing group, Geordie. And talking about vocal groups and backing groups, he moved from The Crescents to the Deltones.
And he spent a number of years with the Deltones, working as obviously a vocalist for them, but he was also beginning to dabble in arranging.
I was their vocal coach and arranger, so I sort of was learning about vocal arranging, and then I became more interested in instrumental arranging. I always played a bit of piano, and then the saxophone sort of come later. I started to study it myself, if you want. I just got hold of a whole lot of books and things, and then whenever I had to write any orchestrations, because we would work with different bands around the clubs, and then when we went overseas, we'd work with bands in Manila, and we'd have to have music for the musicians. So I'd write a big band book.
Yeah, Cole, a very talented musician. When we were talking to Warren Daly, because, of course, Cole was in the Daly Wilson big band as well, and Warren just said that one day he was with the Deltones, and then he was looking around and saw a saxophone and picked it up, and within 5 minutes he was a jazz... That's right. He was a jazz musician. So very clever indeed. And, George, one of Cole's mates in the Deltones was Jimmy Doyle, and Jimmy Doyle was to come back into his life.
He was the one who called me. I went over to England in 1972 and 72, 73 with my family, and we went through Europe, and then we lived in London for a year, and I got a call, and he said, look, do you want to come back? Are you coming back to Australia? I said, yeah, well, I've got to come back eventually. He said, look, there's this band that I've got together with, you know, Mark Kennedy and Duncan McGuire, and at that time I think Ray Burton was in it playing guitar, and I think they just thought of the name of Ayers Rock.
And the first album, Big Red Rock, has quite an iconic cover where the inner sleeve that you pull out has the rock printed on it, and sort of the overlay, I guess, is a cutout of the shape of Uluru. Mm. And as you slide it out, the rock comes out of the sleeve. A great record, quite an influential one, now one that's held in quite high regard, recorded in Melbourne at the Armstrong Studios. Picked up fans in all sorts of interesting places, and that first album was recorded for Mushroom. Michael Gadinsky at the time was interested in marketing the Mushroom stable overseas.
Took it overseas and played it for people over there, several labels, including A&M, and this is what happened.
He went over there with Skyhawk's albums and various, Daddy Cool, I believe, and the other ones, and Madelake and a few other bands that he had. He went to A&M and they liked ours. They liked the Big Red Rock album and asked us to come over and record. I think he got quite a surprise, because we were a bit, you know, different to the other bands in the fact that we were more jazzy, and we did fuse musics together where the other bands were pretty much pop bands or just straight rock bands. We were a bit of both. And so I think he got a real surprise when they liked our album. Mm. He rang us up actually at about 3 o'clock in the morning from LA and said, guess what? They love the Big Red Rock album. We said, great, that's good. You know, I think he was a bit surprised, because I don't know if he really understood what we were doing at the time.
But the Americans obviously got it. And that resulted in quite a sizable deal to go over to the States and record another album.
Of course, the budget that we got was pretty big. It was $60,000 that we got from A&M to do the second album, Beyond, which was a fair bit of money in those days back in the 70s.
Pretty exciting. One album down, they get the invite, $60,000 to go to the States and cut another one.
And the label they cut it for was A&M, owned by Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. At that stage, of course, A&M were absolutely huge. And they cut the record at the record plant. And anybody who was anybody in the musical field at that stage was cutting at the record plant.
Stevie Wonder was recording there when we were there. And we were lucky enough to go and watch him, actually go and meet him and watch him actually put down a couple of tracks. Because, as you know, Stevie Wonder is a multi-instrumentalist, you know, vocalist, harmonica, piano, drums. And so he was doing the lot. He was overdubbing all this stuff. And we went in and he said, "Oh, you guys want to hang around for a while? Yeah, just sit over there." That was fine. He was very relaxed. He was inside the booth there, you know, with the keyboard. I think the album he was recording at the time was Inner Visions, I think.
I know what you're thinking. Possibly there's some of Ayers Rock playing on Inner Visions, or perhaps Stevie did a guest appearance on Beyond, but sadly neither of those are the case. What is true, though, is that Beyond is a much more polished album following on from Big Red Rock. It features some great tracks, including this one, Angel in Disguise. That's Ayers Rock and their track Angel in Disguise from the Beyond album.
And I asked Cole, because I thought it might have been a pun on Elvis's Devil in Disguise, but he said, no, not at all. He said, I actually wrote that back in around the 1966, wrote it for my wife as a special tribute to her, because he had very nice things to say about his wife, to whom he stayed married for, 46 years.
You're listening to Rare Collections, David and Geordie Kilby playing you some jazz rock classics from years past. And next up is Sun, featuring Renee Geyer. Sadly, don't have an interview with Renee to go with this one. And Keith Shadwick, who was one of the driving forces in the band, passed away a couple of years ago. But an interesting band. On the back, they purport to be one of the first in this new style of jazz rock. An album that they released came out in 1972. It's called Sun 72. And I guess what's most interesting about it is that Renee Geyer, who has had a very long and successful career both in Australia and internationally as a soul and funk singer, this is her first appearance on record. The band were actually already together when Renee Geyer came across them. They asked her to join them. She was only, I think, in her late teens at the time, but already you can hear the great Renee Geyer voice very much present. Keith Shadwick, who I mentioned, was the driving force in the band, played tenor, alto, soprano, saxophones, flute, clarinet, wrote for many years as a jazz critic for a number of magazines, and I think had a store in the UK at one point that sold music books primarily on the subject of jazz. Chris Sonnenberg, who was the lead guitarist, was an American expat in Australia, and George Almanza, who was the pianist, was a close friend of Renee Geyer's, and it was George and Renee who sort of came to the band just before the recording of this album in 1972.
And is it experimental in sound, George?
Yeah, look, it is. It's got some fairly experimental stuff on it. It's interesting that the personal manager and friend of the band was Horst Leipold, who, of course, was involved very heavily in jazz in and around Sydney for many, many, many years before going to New York and setting up a famous jazz club there.
Because he was involved with The Basement, wasn't he?
He was very involved with The Basement at one point. Let's take a listen to a track from Sun 72, now quite a collectible record. It didn't sell a lot of copies. Featuring Renee Geyer, this is the track Vendetta. Listen to me, all you people out there. I'm gonna tell you why you feel the bear. I am the one to put you here. And I'm gonna pay you back for all your tears. Now, that's Vendetta by Sun, featuring teenage Renee Geyer, and it notes on the back of the record that that was a big favourite amongst live audiences back in the early 1970s. This is Recollections. We're playing some jazz rock classics this time round. And last up, the band who pretty much set the pace for fusion music in Australia during the latter part of the 1970s, a band called Crossfire, featured guitarist Jim Kelly, who's had a long and very interesting career. And before he was in Crossfire, interestingly enough, he was in another band called Scra with Australian guitarist Peter Martin and a whole host of others. They were, in effect, another big band, although with quite a different sound to the Daly Wilson big band.
Scra, standing for what, George?
Southern Contemporary Rock Assembly.
And Geordie, he and Peter Martin are still sort of connected as teachers.
That's right. They're both currently teaching music and guitar at school in Lismore. This is how they first got together in Scra.
What happened with the Scra band was Peter Martin came back from overseas. He'd been studying guitar in Spain, then went back to London and got involved in the sort of avant-garde jazz scene over there, playing guitar and playing noises and mad sort of stuff. And when he got back to Australia, I'd been looking for him as a young man to get lessons from him. So he arrived back. I think I was about 18 or something like that. I went over to his house to have a lesson. I spent all afternoon with him. By the end of the afternoon, I was in a band with him.
Scra, it's an interesting name, Southern Contemporary Rock Assembly.
There's a lot in the selection of a name. You go from Scra to Crossfire. So we asked Jim, what was in that name?
It was a Crusaders tune. And we loved the Crusaders, and I still do. That's another sound that captivated me and all my mates, that funky Crusaders sound when they morphed from the Jazz Crusaders into just being called the Crusaders. And that was one of their tunes, and we, you know, when you try to get a name for a band, you sit around and have a few drinks and everyone says the silliest thing that comes to mind, and eventually you find one. And when we thought about that, we went, that's the way we play. It's like this crossfire. We're firing all the time. Because we used to improvise a lot.
And the improvisation was quite successful. The band started off in 1975, and before long they were drawing massive crowds, not just in their hometown of Sydney, regular gigs at French's Tavern and places like that, but when they toured to places like Melbourne, they were pulling serious crowds.
It was so popular. I can remember when Crossfire, which sort of led the charge really and kind of held the charge for a long time, I believe. When we're at our peak, we used to go down to Melbourne. We could do 10 nights in a row in 10 different hotels in Melbourne and have people queued up outside, letting one person in as one person goes out. 10 gigs in pubs in a row. Because no one had ever, ever heard anything live like that before in their lives.
It wasn't long after that they put down their first album.
Yeah, interesting album, Jordan. We're always interested in album covers. Even though it came out in the 70s, this is very much a 60s cover, I think. It's in black and white. It's quite psychedelic in a way, with six figures on the front, just the headpieces, an owl over in the corner there, but long hair, tresses you could almost call them. It's quite a striking cover, really, for the time.
I've always been a fan of the opening track on the album, Remember the Trees, and it's a track that Jim Kelly wrote for it.
When we started doing this stuff down at French's Tavern, we fairly much had one song. So we'd do the Miles Davis kind of thing and just play that song for a whole set, then have a few more drinks, take a break, and then sort of play it again for the second set, you know, just make up all this sort of stuff. So anyway, as we realised that we needed to get more material, so we started to play tunes by the Crusaders and went, oh, this is all good fun, but we want to forge our own identity with this. And Mick Kenny had started to write. And I went, oh, gee, well, I'll try and write songs. I've never tried before. The first tune I ever wrote was Remember the Trees. And lo and behold, it came up good enough to go onto an album. So it woke something up in me that, oh, okay, maybe I can do this as well.
Trees from the first in a series of very successful albums for Crossfire in the late 1970s.
He played, as he said, gigs like French's Tavern, building up a big audience there. But in Sydney, they built an even bigger audience, perhaps, at the Basement.
So much so that they may have even at one point saved the Basement from closing.
When we first wanted to put Crossfire in there, the powers that be, Horst Leopold, I think it was, opposed it because he went, well, it's not jazz, et cetera, and so on. So there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, but we won the day. And so the Basement was a really important place for us. We certainly won the day. And then, as it turned out, in hindsight, which I didn't know, we basically saved the Basement from folding in on itself.
Which has been a great favour to musicians ever since.
Oh, and audiences.
Thanks for joining us for this issue of Rare Collections. We will, of course, be back in a fortnight's time with another view into some obscure corner of Australian pop music history. We've only just touched the surface on jazz rock bands in Australia. Others that you should check out if your interest has been piqued here are the Sirius album, which Jackie Ozaski played on, which is well worth checking out. David Fennell also put out some interesting fusion albums in the late 1970s with a South American flavour to them as well. These have been just the tip of the iceberg. And if you're hearing us on digital radio, then we'd encourage you to check out the Rare Collections website, where there is a whole host of other episodes. We've covered things like the first rock and roll record in Australia to surf singles of the early 60s.
And the importance of kangaroos in Australian pop music.
Yes, it's not always quite so academic, although maybe
it's never academic.
Anyway, there's a whole host more there to check out. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you in a fortnight's time.
Thanks for listening to this 666 ABC Canberra podcast. To subscribe to this or any of our podcasts, go to abc.net.au/Canberra.